for downloading this episode of New Books in Sports. I'm your host, Bruce Berglund. For each episode of the podcast, we choose an interesting new book about some area of world sport, and we talk with the author. My guests for this episode are Jim Holstein and Rick Jones, both members of the sociology department at Marquette University. They are the co-authors, along with George Kuntz Jr., of the book, Is There Life After Football? Surviving the NFL, just published in December 2014 by New York University Press. This book is the result of research into the experiences of hundreds of former NFL players, from recent years back to veterans of the 1960s and 70s. Jim and Rick discuss, first of all, how the NFL is a bubble of privilege, where players' needs are met by their teams, allowing them to focus all of their attention, energy, and time on football. But, as we learn, when players leave that bubble, in most cases unwillingly, they find themselves unprepared for life in the real world. In many cases, young men in their late 20s and early 30s leave the league without sustainable financial planning, with no skills training other than in playing football, and with an inability to even interact with people other than teammates and coaches. The result is often psychological struggle and social isolation, not to mention the physical damage brought by years of football. Yet, as we hear in the interview, these former players insist that they would do it all again. The book, Is There Life After Football?, is a revealing and readable look into the day-to-day workings of America's most popular sport, as well as a troubling account of the toll that sport takes on more than the bodies of its players. Here's my interview with Jim Holstein and Rick Jones. This week's guests on New Books in Sports are Rick Jones and Jim Holstein. So, Rick, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Bruce.
And Jim, welcome to New Books in Sports.
We're happy to be here.
So, to start the podcast, we typically have a few words of introduction about the guests. So, I'll ask each of you in turn to tell us a bit about your background, your research interests, and I guess it would be appropriate to have you say something about your interests in football. So, Rick, would you like to go first?
Sure. I'm a professor of sociology at Marquette University. I teach a sociology of sport class, and that's kind of how I got involved in this line of research. Ordinarily, I do research on prison inmates and the challenges they have at reentering society. And I suppose, ironically, in the last chapter, we do make some sort of mm-hmm. connection between the lives of NFL players within the game and the experiences of prison inmates.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And Jim?
Yeah, I'm also a sociologist at Marquette. My interest in football is mostly as a sports fan, although years and years ago I did publish an article on actually, it was on football and mental health. Mm-hmm. But since then, my interest has mostly been generated by just being a sports fan in general. And this was an opportunity to get to bring some of the things that I've always liked to do into the professional arena with me.
And we should say a word as well at the start about the third co-author of the book, who couldn't join us today, but he was really the key figure in the genesis of the book. So could you say a word about George Kuntz and his role in the development of this project?
Yeah. Well, nearly a decade ago, George was the director of player development. During his time there, he was connected to the president of the Packers, who happens to be on the board of directors of Marquette. And George was interested in pursuing a graduate degree. And he was interested in doing some research on football. And so we got paired up only because I was teaching a sociology of sport class. He came to talk to me about some of his ideas or interests, and that's where it all began.
And we should say, too, that George played, was it 9 years, 10 years in the NFL?
I believe it was 9 years. He played the first eight, I think it was the first eight for the Packers, and he spent 1 year in Seattle where he was, even in his declining days, he was starting linebacker for the full season there.
Okay, so he was a linebacker. He played in two Super Bowls, won one Super Bowl with the Packers. So so this project really began out of his research and coming to you both. And I'll ask at the start about the research that George did initially, and then the three of you continued. Can you talk about your sources and in particular about the interviews that are at the core of this study?
Okay, well, in the beginning, George's dissertation was primarily about role transitions of NFL players, both into football and out of football. And so he created a small kind of snowball sample of former NFL players. That was actually the beginning of the project, and it took him a number of years, of course, to collect the data, analyze it, complete his PhD. And once that was over, then we explored the idea of expanding the project to include a much larger sample of players. And I can let Jim talk a little bit more about the expansion of the project beyond George's dissertation.
Yeah, well, as any sports fan knows, who is more often interviewed, more frequently interviewed, than ball players? And there's just a wealth of data, if you will, that's constantly available, especially now online. And so, in addition to the interviews that George conducted and that Rick and I participated in to a limited extent along the way, we've drawn upon literally thousands of pages of interviews that are public access interviews, where we can explore some of the same issues that we've seen in the project that George started, looking to be careful not to just take promiscuously off the internet anything that's said, but to look at the sources, to look for corroboration, much as a good journalist might do, in order to expand what we have from George's initial interviews into a much, much, much larger data set. And what we have here then is a core, that the core of the book follows issues that often have come up in George's playing career itself. We use George as a touchstone to many of the issues. Not that he's an exemplar of everything, and not that he's certainly a great example of how to succeed in all instances, but what George went through and what we learned from speaking to all of these players was that there's a set of issues that come up in players' lives when they're leaving the game that are common, that are recurrent, and that the general public often isn't very well informed about. And that's where we got interested in trying to enrich our understanding of life after football.
Well, let's look at the book and see what you discovered in the course of this research. So even though the book focuses on life after a career in professional football, the first two chapters, going back to George's original research, the first two chapters discuss players' experiences in reaching the NFL and then playing in the league. And I want to ask you in particular about your first chapter, which describes the path to pro football. And in that chapter, you use two contradictory terms to describe the paths of aspiring players, that these young players, on the one hand, are pursuing a dream, but that they're also getting onto a conveyor belt. So can you talk about that contrast of the dream and the conveyor belt of high-level college football, then moving into the pros?
Yeah, well, we certainly hear from almost every player that we interviewed that they did dream of having a sports career. Those dreams aren't unique to them. All of us had those sorts of dreams. The difference is these guys had talent, and it was identified relatively early in their lives. And when we talk about the conveyor belt is a term that was coined by, I believe, sports journalist William C. Roden from the New York Times, where he talks about, he's talking primarily about young black athletes, but I think it pertains to any young elite athlete along the way, that early on in these guys' lives, they're identified as being special in one fashion or another, and their careers, outsiders, older people, usually adults, start to pull them along into an athletic career that starts when they're 8 or 10 years old. I was just watching on TV this morning. Look, LeBron James' son is now being courted and given scholarship offers to play basketball at college, and he's 10 years old. We talk about in the book about a couple of kids who are already being offered scholarships, football scholarships, to programs like Alabama and LSU when they're 12 years old. We see that kids are put on a fast track, identified as good athletes, and then put on a fast track to pursuing these careers by being dragged into, or them not being dragged into, but them willingly wanting to participate in Pee Wee football, in AAU teams, in traveling teams in soccer and volleyball and whatever. And they start down this road towards a career when they're mere children. And by the time they're in high school, they're identified as being elite athletes. They put most of their time into cultivating their skills. If their parents have the wherewithal, they have them in all sorts of camps and traveling teams and elite programs. Then they start to be courted by college recruiters who imagine, if you will, imagine what you would be told if you were LeBron James' son and what a special person you were. Well, the Division I football athlete, when he's recruited, is told from the time he's first identified that he's special and that he's that they want him. Imagine, again, Nick Saban, maybe the greatest college football coach of all time, sitting down across the table in the living room with a 12-year-old and trying to convince this 12-year-old to join him in his program. The kid's got to think that he's special. And that conveyor belt picks the kid up and sort of moves him along through. So by the time they get to college, they've committed themselves to a life of athletics. They've committed themselves to a particular vision of themselves. And it's hard to get off. When back to that conveyor belt, if they're good enough, it'll carry them right through college and put them on the doorsteps of a professional career.
So, Jim, picking up on that, you talk about these young players in elementary school or middle school that they're already identified as being special by virtue of their athletic talent. But something that you talk about in that first chapter, and this is something that carries throughout the book, is that there's a dark side, you could say, to this special status. So can you talk about that?
Well, the dark side of being special in that respect is the expectations that come along with always being treated as different, and often as different than other kids' age peers. We talk about football players entering the bubble somewhere along the line. We talk mainly about the bubble as the life in the NFL, but players are in a bubble from the time they're in high school. George can tell stories about special treatment, and George was not identified as an elite athlete early on. He was not a highly recruited high school star, but he was the best player on his high school team, and he can talk about being treated special, getting special perks, getting attention from classmates, from young women, getting having people overlook some of his academic shortcomings. And so that, in a way, the players don't have to carry their own weight in many of the dimensions of life that most of us do. When they get into college, it's sort of the same thing. When you're on scholarship, people care about you maintaining your eligibility, perhaps more than they care about you getting an education. And when that's the primary goal, maybe these magnificent academic support services that are available at almost all Division I universities maybe the concern is more about getting student athletes into courses where they can maintain their eligibility rather than getting them into a program where they might prepare themselves for life after they're done with college. And so that's kind of the dark side of the specialness. They're cultivated from a very early age to become football players. And they don't go through some of the same things that most college students do to become full-fledged adults.
There's also another kind of downside to the conveyor belt, and that is as great athletes, in the beginning, they may play a variety of sports, right? But at some point in time, they're going to start focusing on one. That usually comes at either the request of a coach that says, you need to pick this sport and not play any of these others, or at the athlete himself who chooses, if I really want to make it to the top level, I've got to focus only on this one thing. And so what you find is kind of a narrowing of kind of opportunities and options, right? And this can come back to haunt them later on in their lives.
Well, let's talk about when they reach the NFL for those who do. And the title of your chapter on the life of current players in the NFL is called Inside the Bubble. And I think this was George's term, right? The idea of the NFL as a bubble. So can you talk about that? How does the National Football League function as a bubble?
I hate to refer to the bubble as a total institution, but in many respects, what George is talking about is both in the NFL and in college, that their whole lives center around the sport that they play, so that everything else is kind of secondary to the football. Right. So if we're in Green Bay and, you know, we're preparing for the season, I might have my wife or my girlfriend or other family members who are taking care of all my household duties and chores and responsibilities that I'm going to spend from sunup to sundown at the Packers facilities. In addition, the professional team is going to take care of most of my basic needs. They're going to feed me. They're going to clothe me. You know, they're going to even try to teach me how to fill out a checkbook when I'm a rookie player. So this notion of the bubble is that everything is centered on being the best football player that one can be, and therefore removing all of the things that would be unrelated to football, but everybody else has to, you know, pay attention to or take care of themselves.
So picking up with that, with looking at the various drawbacks to life in the bubble, one that was striking to me that you discuss in the book is the wear that players living in the bubble, that has on relationships with their partners, with their wives. And there's a statement in the book, and I think it was from George, that NFL teams want their players to get married because it brings an element of stability to their lives. But life in the NFL isn't necessarily good for marriages.
Yeah, let me talk about that a little bit. It's the players believe that it would be a good thing for them to get married because they think that that's one more thing that the team wants them to do. Now, I'm not so sure that the team necessarily says that or imposes that, but that's certainly a belief among the players that it's a sign of stability. Now, imagine, if you will, though, the relationship that the players have with their lives, with their wives, with their families, and others close to them when they are essentially unavailable for 12 to 14 hours a day, where they're tired and beat up, and players are beat up during the season, when they're tired and beat up, when they are away from the game, and they're trying to concentrate on preparing for the game at the end of the week. They, as Rick said earlier, most of the details of everyday life are turned over to spouses or girlfriends or other family members. If you recall, well, just take an example, Brett Favre, when he came to Green Bay, it wasn't long after that he brought a brother and a friend from Kiln, Mississippi to come up and live with him. Now, one might think that that's guys bringing their posse along with them just to enjoy a good time. But it's not just that. It's that it's somebody there to help shovel the walks when it snows, to shop so that they've got something to eat. It's some people just to take care of one's life. And when it comes down to a marriage, what we see often, and I don't want to characterize this as a bunch of bad guys taking advantage of their wives, but these relationships are often very one-sided. The wife has to also give her life completely over to managing the life of a player. And so what we've seen from many interviews with players' wives is they've given up quite a bit. And when the players come to the end of their career, wives are often ready to set out and take up their own lives. And that puts players in a very delicate situation where they're feeling at a loss and feeling like they need some sympathy for everything they've just lost, when the wives are ready to take off running. And they're not all that sympathetic because they're finally getting to do what they need to do after maybe putting in 12 years of taking care of the players' needs.
Jim really does hit on it, that wives who, for the most part, are also college educated, since many of them met their husbands while they were in college, have made significant sacrifices. And so when the end of the career arrives, they really do believe that it's now their time to kind of focus on themselves. And of course, the football players may not be really ready to retire at that point. They're still trying to get back into the game and so on. So that creates a little bit of turmoil within the husband-wife relationship.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about the end of an NFL career. And speaking as a longtime fan of pro football, this was something I had not really been aware of. That most players' careers do not end with a retirement announcement and a clear break from the league. The end of the average career is much more murky and much more drawn out. So can you talk about how the average career comes to an end?
There may not be a typical ending to a career, but one of the things that we did discover is that, as you just suggested, Bruce, that it's very uncommon for a player to decide he's done, to call a press conference and say, I'm retiring, and for that retirement to stick. Just turn your back the pages to Brett Favre's several attempts to retire. But if you listen closely, when players do want to retire, and it seems to be on their own terms, they're almost always leaving some small door open, because maybe an injury will happen. A wide receiver will go down later in the season, and then maybe you'll want me back because I know the playbook and I can step right in if I stay in shape. So what happens, what the typical ending of a career, one typical pattern anyway, is that players outlive their usefulness with a particular team, or they become too expensive relative to other younger players. And for example, George's career, George was a starting linebacker for the Packers. He experienced a couple of injuries, and at the end of his last season with the Packers, where he had not had any inkling that his career was coming to an end, they decided to tell him they were going in another direction, and they weren't going to pick up the last year of his contract, remembering that in the NFL, no contract is guaranteed. No contract is guaranteed. Some guys get a lot of money up front with signing bonuses, but you can be cut at any time. And so when the Packers decided they needed to go in another direction, they simply told George, we don't need your services any longer. He managed to hook up with Seattle at quite a reduced salary, moved himself out to Seattle, played a season out there, left town with no word that he hadn't done well, and simply didn't hear from the Seahawks for several months. He has to call his agent. He has to call his friends, his coaches back with Seattle. And he only hears in a roundabout way that Seattle, too, is going to go in a different direction. And so here's George Kuntz, who is still fully believes that he's a productive starting player in the NFL, who has never been slowly eased out of the picture. He started every game in his last year in Seattle. he's without a job, but nobody tells him that he's through, he's washed up. They simply tell him, we're going in a different direction. Stay ready. Maybe we'll give you a call. And that's the problem that many players face, is they don't know that it's over, and they end up spending years staying ready. George spent almost three years thinking, waiting by the phone, that somebody was going to give him a call and he was going to continue to play.
And working out and training and so forth.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, it's not only working out and training, it is not pursuing any other interests.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So their focus is still trying to get back into the game rather than moving on and, you know, getting more education or trying to start a new career.
And when somebody does, in the case of George, when his wife does tell him it's over, he didn't handle it too well.
No, I think, you know, that tells you a little bit of how their identities revolve so firmly around this football thing. And so without any other real interest going on, you know, they just cling to football for as long as they possibly can. Mm-hmm. And it's not until there's until George's wife actually points out to him that he can have this kind of turning point. I mean, it wasn't a wonderful turning point. I mean, it's pretty dramatic. But once he gets past it, then he can start kind of turning the ship in another direction and moving forward.
Let me pick up on something you just said there, Rick, where you talked about with football being all consuming, they don't have the opportunity to develop other interests. Is that the case? And you don't discuss this in the book, but is the bubble and the task of preparing for football and living within the bubble of the NFL, is it so time consuming that even cultivating interests, you know, reading or developing an interest in some other area of life, so let alone pursuing another degree, is even that pushed off to the side?
Well, I think that, you know, you actually almost have to step back to college too, because you can see that, you know, a college scholarship, a full ride to college to play football, provides one the opportunity to get an education. And, you know, a large percentage of the football players do get college degrees. But we have to be honest, a majority of these players are there to play football, and that the education oftentimes takes a back seat. So getting a degree does not necessarily equate to getting an education or getting a well-rounded education. While some players that have almost seamless exits from football and into another career, generally those folks have had an eye to the future, right? They've realized or recognized that football is a short-term profession, and they've got a long life to live, and so they're thinking in the future. And George was actually like that. I mean, he selected a major that was in the construction industry. His father worked in that line of work. George had worked as a student, you know, in construction. So he was actually, you know, getting in a degree that he thought he could use later on. But you're right. In terms of once they get into the bubble in football, the NFL provides all kinds of opportunities for internships, for, you know, picking up college credits if you don't have a degree. But because the players really go all in for the football aspect of it, I think they're, in some ways, many of the players are kind of afraid to take a month off or six weeks off from training, you know, to do an internship or something of that sort. I mean, it's really amazing, you know, the diversity of opportunities that the and programs that the NFL does provide in terms of career development and things of that sort. And many players do take advantage of them, but there's another group that don't take full advantage of the opportunities that are available.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the issues we should discuss is money. And one of the important points of your book is that the huge contracts that NFL players sign don't necessarily give an accurate picture of their actual financial situations, so of both active and former players. And one thing you mentioned earlier is that there is no such thing as a guaranteed contract in the NFL. It's just a series of one-year contracts. So can you talk about the financial situation that former players find themselves in at the end of their careers?
Well, it's not that they don't make good money for men of their age, but compared to other professional athletes, NFL players are vastly underpaid. They don't make – we hear right now, it's almost baseball season. We're hearing about free agency in baseball where people are – fringe players are making several million dollars a year. Less than half the roster in an NFL team is going to make $1 million a year, and more players are making, say, less than $700,000 a year than make more than that. And so the wealth of an NFL player is probably exaggerated. The length of his career is uncertain. And so while they are making, compared to the other kids who are going to college with them, they come out of college, and if even the low man on the totem pole, the last guy on the roster, is going to make nearly $500,000 if he makes the roster, if that only lasts for 3.5 years, he hasn't made enough to live on that for the rest of his life. And because of that, even if he hasn't squandered his money, he won't be set for the rest of his life, and he's going to have to set off on to support himself just like the rest of us do. And I think that's one of the problems Rick has already alluded to, is they get used to the players come into relatively big money, some of them for extraordinarily big money, at a relatively young age, and it's not that the money runs out, but the career runs out, and they haven't looked far enough down the road to realize that they're going to have to, maybe at the age of 28 or 29, to pick up and do something else. They're not going to make enough to live for the rest of their lives on. That doesn't seem like it should be a tremendous hardship for them. How many 28-year-olds can be walking around with $1 million, say, in the bank? Now, $1 million won't last you forever, and you've got to go to work, perhaps. Most 28-year-olds expect that. Problem in the NFL, and something that we've called in the book bad benchmarking, is that players think about what they need to do next in terms of what they've already done. And when they think about the next job that they want to hold, they're not thinking about what's reasonable for a 28- or 30-year-old man with a college degree to be making. They're thinking about, How much should I be making relative to what I have always made up to this point? When George, who did not, he signed a couple of very good contracts. George was a nice middle of the pack player at a time just after free agency hit. So he made some good money. He signed a couple of really good contracts. But when he was done, he was not set for life. You mentioned the stories about George's wife. George, she encouraged him to apply for jobs at Eastern Carolina University, where he was getting a graduate degree and also working with and around the athletic department. He was offered a job, this is maybe a decade ago now, at the same, just about the same salary that an assistant professor of, say, English would make. So it's not a great salary, but it's nothing to sneeze at, too. George felt insulted that they would offer him so little in the athletic department. His agent told George to go back and, excuse the language, but to tell him to kiss your ass, George. You don't work for that kind of money. Okay, now, this is the point was, this is a perfectly reasonable, in the larger scheme of things, salary for an entry-level position. And he was only 30, 31 years old at the time. But what he was comparing this to, he was benchmarking this against $1 million, $1.5 million he made in the last couple of years of his career. This is a phenomenon that turns up time after time we hear in interviews of players thinking that something is, in a sense, beneath them to take what would be generally considered a pretty good, well-paying job. I don't know if you remember, a couple of years ago, remember Robert Parrish, who's now a Hall of Fame NBA basketball player, who played with the great Celtic teams of the 80s and early 90s. He was terribly upset with some of his former teammates, Larry Bird, Kevin McHale in particular, because they held executive positions in the NBA. They were running teams, and he wanted them to give him a job. Parrish at the time said that he thought it was just appalling that Bird or McHale couldn't find a position for him. Parrish saying, "All I need there is a job, a six-figure salary, and I'll be perfectly happy." All I need is a six-figure salary. And unfortunately, many of the NFL players think along those lines too. I was making $1 million. Shall I take a job for $40,000? That's beneath me. And that proves to be a big roadblock of looking for another big payday and ignoring other good payday opportunities.
All of us, you know, many of us, you know, create a lifestyle based on the income that we have. Mm-hmm. If I have $1 million a year salary, then I probably have $1 million a year lifestyle. Mm-hmm. And not many people want to cut back on that lifestyle when the game's over. Mm-hmm. And so to try to find another career that's going to allow them to maintain the lifestyle that they're used to, that's not very realistic for most of these players.
Mm-hmm. And something I noted when in talking about moving to their post-career professions is there's a particular reluctance to go into coaching because of that fact. And you would think that a number of players would want to get back into the bubble of the game, but coaching positions don't pay all that well.
Well, as George has pointed out to us, coaches have to work too hard for the for the money they make. So, you know, they're there just as many hours as the football players are, if not more. And they're not making the head coach is making a great salary and maybe the top two assistant coaches are. But, you know, I think a typical pro football team has 20 to 22 coaches. And, you know, the assistant to the assistant to the assistant head coach, you know, is not making a significant amount of money. But they're still putting all that time in.
You've got to remember that when players are in meetings around training camp or around the practice facility, during those meetings, the lowest paid person in the room is the coach. Mm-hmm. And except for the offensive and defensive coordinators and the head coach, that's almost universally true. And I can't say enough how many times we heard players saying it's just too much work. Players may think that they like coaching and they may dabble in, helping out with the high school team here and there. But when you give them the full responsibility that a high school coach would have, that's a lot of work. Plus, the fact is most high school coaches are also high school teachers. And that's a full-time job. Again, something that players are not as inclined today to pursue as they might once have been. And so coaching, for the most part, is something NFL players don't avidly pursue. And if you look at the coaching staffs in the NFL, it's not populated with a lot of former NFL players. They're relatively rare.
All right, so we can wrap this up. I think one big message is NFL players, when they leave their careers, are not ready for work. They're not ready for the reality of the working environment. And the other thing that struck me is they're not even ready for basic social interactions when they leave the league.
Unfortunately, that sometimes is true, that they living in the bubble, living in a cultural milieu, it's extremely competitive. It's an extremely masculine environment. It's a world unlike anything else where camaraderie and loyalty and competitiveness rule the day, and then all of a sudden that goes away. It's a world that's dominated by big, strong, fast, smart black men, and then they're asked to move into some other sort of environment, and it's not only the big, strong, smart black men who are fish out of water, it's the white guys too. It's an environment unlike anything else. You can recall what all the big controversy a year and a half ago with Richie Incognito and the Miami Dolphins, and how everyone was appalled at that what was going on in the Dolphins locker room and what an ugly scene it must have been. Well, what comes out of that, if you just stepped back 2 days from when that first, the controversy first broke, we heard player after player, both on the Dolphins and other locker rooms, saying, well, you know, this sounds bad, but Richie Incognito isn't that bad of a guy, and acting like this and making players put the team first and making guys put their lives on the line and step forward in these very masculine, macho ways, that's normal. And it's an environment that's probably less, players will universally contend that the racial climate of the NFL is something like they see nowhere else in their lives, that things, there's a level playing field there, that race matters, but it doesn't hold you back. That's a kind of, there are situations in various different ways where when a player leaves that environment, when he leaves the bubble, as you said, Bruce, he's not quite ready to interact, or he doesn't, it's not that he doesn't have necessarily the skills, but he's not well practiced in interacting in normal everyday environments. Mm-hmm.
In addition to that, they also develop a certain sense of entitlement. When everything's done for you, you know, there's not a lot of social cost to even many of the public miscues they get involved in. While there's someone that checks the color of their socks before a game to make sure that they're not violating uniform policy and things of that sort, when the game's over, you know, they may still feel a certain sense of entitlement or glory, but when they're not in the game anymore, all of that goes away. People don't treat them as special as they used to. The Adlers wrote a very interesting book about college basketball players, and they note the challenges that the seniors, you know, during their last year of playing basketball. They're no longer the toast of the town. They no longer receiving the favors of the boosters because they're on the way out. And I think that's one of the challenges that former NFL players face.
Now, let me ask you, you did talk with players whose careers were in the 60s and the 70s. And did you find, has there been a change in post-career transitions from that era to today?
Well, I think that the biggest the biggest difference is that if you go back to the 60s and 70s, and salaries were so low. I mean, a $10,000 payday was big time in the 60s. So two things that we note about them is, one, the degree of athleticism. You know, players were not training year-round to get their bodies in the best possible shape and condition that they possibly can. It was much more typical. The seasons were shorter, and it was much more typical for players to have a job during the off-season, right, to supplement their football income. So in some ways, you know, if you're kind of used to either substitute teaching or selling cars or whatever you might have been doing in the off season, that at least prepared you for when the game was over. I think players in the 60s and 70s were still just as, you know, eager to play the game, to extend their careers as long as they could. They certainly enjoyed the life of being a professional athlete. But the reality was is that the money wasn't there. And so they were forced, you know, to prepare for a life beyond the game.
We should ask about the physical toll of playing in the NFL, and you do have a chapter on the injuries, the pain that former players have to endure. You do discuss the recent findings related to brain disease in former players. And the one thing I want to ask you is, in your interviews and in the research you did, for all of the pain and the post-career surgeries and now the mounting evidence of brain disease, did you find many players who have regrets?
That's a really interesting thing here, is almost to a man, the players will now say, I'm worried about the brain damage thing. Players will almost always say, geez, I'm hurting. I'm going to need to have this joint replaced or that one. But those same guys, every single one of them, every single one says, I'd do it all again. And it's as simple as that. They feel that having played the game was worth the price, even if they know. I'm amazed when I talk with George, when I listen to George talking about this, he can list off the 7 or 8 major surgeries that he's had, his concerns about whether or not the half dozen concussions that he knows he experienced are going to have some lasting impact. But if you ask him or you ask any of his fellow players if they do it again, absolutely. Absolutely, they'd say.
You know, Jim and I had the privilege, you know, of, as fanboys, we got to go to Packer Alumni Weekend up in Green Bay. And we went to a kind of a coffee hour where there were, I think there may have been 10 or 12 players just gathering around in the lounge. And the conversation clearly, you know, all began with, hi, how you doing? They say, fine, everything's going well, and so on. But it didn't take very long for the conversation then to turn on knee replacements, surgeries, or the various aches and pains that they were experiencing.
And I'll jump in here. I remember that section in the book where you write about this. And these are men who are in their 40s. So these aren't men in their 60s or 70s, correct?
Right. So, but, you know, again, they talk about it just matter-of-factly. It's for them, it's just a part of life. But I would agree with Jim. At least the people that we've talked to and researched, they would do it all over again. And more importantly, many of the players are very concerned about the direction the game is going. You know, the NFL is concerned about the health of the players. At least publicly, they state that. They're making efforts to try to make the game safer. You know, they're changing rules to protect defensive players and not using the helmet as a weapon and so on. But many of the players do not like the direction that the game's going. You know, real men don't need these protections. And so it's like they're taking the fun out of the game. They're changing it in ways that doesn't suit or doesn't fit their understanding of the way the game should be played.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, it's almost time to wrap things up. And so to close, I want to ask both of you that you in the course of this research and working with your former student, George Kuntz, who then became your co-author, and he allowed this view into the bubble. What, I'll ask you, each of you, what did you find most surprising in the course of this research?
Go ahead, Jim.
the most surprising, well, I think it's one of the things that's, it's a combination of things. It was surprising to me that the players were so deeply immersed in the game, and they cared about it so much and loved it so much. Being a fan, sometimes you get jaded into thinking these are just a bunch of rich guys out to play the game and as long as they can and come away with as much money as they can. Well, that is very important to them, but what they all share in common is a deep passion for the game and, as Rick has said, for the life that goes on in the bubble. Having said that, what surprised me then is how much trouble they have with the relatively mundane things once they leave the game. I'm not surprised that they have health problems, and I'm not surprised that they can blow, let some of them blow literally $1 million. But what surprised me was the way they felt lost and adrift because they didn't have the regimented life where they had 18 hours of the day scheduled, that they didn't have family lives that they could fall back into to provide some of that structure, that they didn't have just the rudimentary things that most of us might turn to when feeling like they're, you know, you're lost and separated from everything you've always known. The players, for example, part of their life, there are a lot of very religious guys in the NFL, and religion is a big part of their experience. But they get their religion in the locker room. The religion is brought to them. It's sort of room service religion. They have a team chaplain. They have team services. Well, that's all well and good. But what surprised me is when they're done with this, well, then their church community, their congregation also goes away too. And they're left out there without the support systems and without all these the trappings of support that they've had. And it was really shocking to me to see how alone and isolated they actually felt.
Yeah, and for me, I mean, I would agree with everything that Jim has said there. But I would take it even a step further in terms of the relationships and social bonds that kind of disappear once they leave the game and at a time when they probably need them the most. You know, when these football players first make the game or, you know, make it in the NFL, they've got everybody, you know, hitting them up for a loan or money. You know, they find cousins and friends that they've never knew existed before. And then they develop these deep bonds with players in the locker room, and they all talk about this wonderful camaraderie. Once they leave the game, they talk about what they miss the most, you know, is the locker room and that camaraderie. And what's interesting is, I'd wonder how many truly great friends they have that are outside of football when they are within that bubble. And when they leave, do they have anyone that they can, you know, talk to? Because when George was sitting at home for 2 years, 2 to 3 years, waiting to get back in the game, he's no longer talking to his boys that are still in the game. You know, he's a little bit embarrassed. You know, they're in, he's not. And so he, you know, fortunately he had his wife, who was a rock for him, but it's like he didn't have anyone else. His agent abandoned him. And I think that's what was surprising. You know, when you're growing up surrounded by people, and then all of a sudden the game's over and you don't have anyone anymore. If you're lucky, you've got a good, you know, a wife. You may still have a strong relationship with your family. But it's those social relationships. I think it surprised me how lacking so many of them were in those relationships.
You've been listening to an interview with Jim Holstein and Rick Jones about their book, Is There Life After Football? Surviving the NFL, co-authored with George Kuntz Jr. and published in 2014 by New York University Press. New Books in Sports is part of the New Books Network, which offers dozens of channels of podcast interviews with the authors of new publications on subjects like religion, politics, biography, popular music, and more. Go to newbooksnetwork.com to find the subjects you're interested in. If you like what you heard here, please follow New Books in Sports on Twitter at New Books Sports, or friend us on Facebook at facebook.com/newbooksinsports. I'm your host, Bruce Berglund. Thanks for listening, and enjoy your week.